Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today Dr. Richard Sternberg, who is a research scientist affiliated with Biologic Institute. Dr. Sternberg holds two PhDs in the biological sciences, and it's really wonderful to have you on the show with us today, Dr. Sternberg.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I know that many of us here at Discovery Institute have heard you talk about the gene and the nature of the genome, and would like today to talk to you about a very basic subject of what is the gene, and what do we mean when we talk about genes, and how has our understanding of what a gene is changed over time?
Certainly. Well, our concept of the gene goes back to roughly 1900. It was developed in the context of population genetics. The 1920s and 30s are expanded upon. And essentially, the gene was understood to be an abstraction. It was a hereditary particle that specified some trait, such as a gene for, say, blue eyes or a gene for brown eyes. The definition of the gene was expanded. You've probably heard the expression, one gene, one enzyme. It was thought that the gene specified an enzyme that would conduct a cellular process or enable a cellular process. And then, of course, with the discovery of the DNA double helix in the early 1950s, the gene became identified with a segment of DNA. But still, the notion was that you have one gene and that gene encodes protein. And that model of the gene held until mid to late 1970s, when it became clear that, unlike the situation in bacteria, our genes are interrupted, they're split. They don't necessarily encode in a straightforward way a protein or an enzyme. But nevertheless, the concept of the gene, the one that we're familiar with, we may have learned about in high school or in the university, seemed more or less solid until relatively recently, when it was discovered that, first of all, you can have one quote-unquote gene and mapping to it, or let's put it this way, derived from that sequence. You can have tens or even in some cases hundreds of different proteins that are derived therefrom. And on top of that, you can have a number of RNA sequences that also derive from the same region of DNA. So with the results of a project called ENCODE, many results of which were published in 2007, it became clear that the notion of a gene as being a discrete sequence of DNA that serves as a template for a set number of proteins and RNAs, in other words, that's a more or less particular entity, disappeared. And that is because we now know that protein coding regions, RNA coding regions, they overlap. They intersect, they're interleaved, they're very complicated organizations. And so where a gene starts and where it ends has become a complicated question. And the fact that the RNA intermediates, some are very small, maybe no more than 20 or so bases in length, others can be thousands, even millions of bases in length. These can span a number of regions that were once just thought to be a single genetic locus. So it's far more complicated. And as a consequence, the definition of the gene now is open. The gene has no easy material description.
So I understand that now we are coming to the realization that there are hundreds of thousands of RNAs that are floating around in our cell that are being transcribed from the DNA, some of them long, some of them short. What are these RNAs doing, and what is the importance of these RNAs in our cells?
Well, it appears in almost all nucleated cellular organisms, eukaryotic organisms, that at one stage or another in their life history, almost every single nucleotide of their DNA sequence is transcribed into RNA. And those RNAs are in turn processed into a number of derivative RNA sequences. And ever since their discovery, it was thought that a large bulk of those sequences were simply promiscuous transcripts, junk RNA, if you will. But we have since learned in organisms as diverse as budding yeast, the fruit fly, the roundworm, mice, ourselves, that these RNAs play multiple roles in the cellular economy and in the process of development. I'll give you some examples. In the case of budding yeast, you have thousands of RNAs that come from the strand that's opposite of the protein-coding regions. These are called antisense RNAs. And until recently, their functions were rather elusive. And a case could be made that these were simply nonsensical RNAs being produced. Well, it turns out that these antisense RNAs fine-tune, they modulate the regulation of the protein-coding region that is on the opposite strand. How do we know this? Do we know this from just inference? No, we know this from direct experimental evidence, where you can knock out these antisense RNAs, and they have an effect on the regulation of their neighboring sequences. That's one example. Another example is that along our chromosomes and the chromosomes of other eukaryotes, some very long non-translatable RNAs are produced. And by long, I mean they can be thousands of bases, or in some cases, millions of bases. And it's since been learned that these RNAs serve as scaffolds. Proteins bind to them, enzymes bind to them, and they are assembly sites for the machineries that are engaged in gene regulation. What you also have is a class of very small RNAs, RNAs that range from about 20 bases in length to 30 bases in length. And the roles that they play, I mean, they're quite diverse. And their numbers are also quite high. It's estimated in the fruit fly, for example, there are 205,000 different species of these small RNAs. One of their roles is that they fine-tune the regulation of protein-coding regions and other regions across the chromosomes. Mm. Not a month goes by that a new class of RNA is not being discovered, or so it seems. The number of different classes of RNAs is quite high and growing.
Now, you made an interesting comment a couple minutes ago that during the lifespan of a eukaryotic organism, at some point, virtually every single nucleotide in the DNA is transcribed into RNA. So our modern understanding of the genome and how it works, what are the implications, of course, for Jonathan Wells' new thesis, The Myth of Junk DNA, that most of our genome is needed? What are we understanding now in terms of junk DNA in the genome?
Well, I'll give you an example, and I'll take the example from the fruit fly, Drosophila, which it has a relatively small DNA set. We have 25 times more DNA. But what's interesting about the fruit fly is that if you have tracked our understanding of the percentage of functional sequences over the past decade, it has only increased. I mean, initially, there were estimates 30 to 40% of the DNA is functional, meaning it's encoding protein. Then there were studies that showed that over 50% of the total DNA appears to be under some form of selective constraint. That is, it doesn't appear to be diverging neutrally. And the estimate that was just released with the Mod Encode project published the end of the last year has raised the estimate to 89 to 90% of the DNA sequences have some form of functionality, meaning that they're either involved in regulating transcription or they are regions necessary for replicating DNA, or they're involved in the folding of the chromosome or the packaging of the chromosome. We often think of DNA as this more or less linear string that's floating in a bag of solution and proteins and RNAs are free to come and go. What we often don't take into account is that, say, in one of our cells, we're talking about literally feet of DNA. It has to be packaged in a very small volume. Moreover, it's complexed with proteins and RNAs. There is no naked DNA in our cells. And it's the same in the fruit fly, same in yeast. It's true also for bacteria. Well, the point is, this DNA has to be packaged. And it has to be packaged in three dimensions in such a way that the cellular machineries can get access to the sequences that need to be accessible, and the other sequences can be compacted and folded. And this involves the attachment of the chromosomes to a framework within the nucleus. And what we find is that you have, in the case of our chromosomes, in the case of the fruit fly chromosomes, case of worm chromosomes, is that you have vast tracts, vast segments of the chromosomes that are just involved in mediating those attachments. So they may not be directly involved even in producing RNAs and then from RNAs proteins. But the fact is, they're the points of interaction between, say, the nuclear membrane and the interior of the nucleus and the chromosome. So that's one kind of functionality that's become clear. Again, when you talk about RNAs, what we're finding is that the diverse classes of transcripts that are produced in the nucleus, they have a number of roles. In some cases, the roles are overlapping. That is, you can have an RNA that does code for a protein. It can be translated into a protein. But at the same time, it can also serve as a scaffold. And then, after it's been used, say, for either of those roles, and it's degraded, so to speak, the products of the degradation can then serve other functionalities. So it seems that very little goes to waste. And it could be that some of the RNAs that are being generated in some of the sequences certainly would fall into the category of junk. But that seems unlikely. And again, just let me quickly mention the fruit fly. About 30% of fruit fly DNA consists of, I guess you'd call them degenerate copies of repetitive DNA sequences. You have miles and miles, if you will, of seeming junk. But those regions have been extensively analyzed. There's a lot to be learned about it, no doubt. But what has become clear is that the regulation of those supposedly degenerate, worthless elements is under tight control. And moreover, they are transcribed, and that transcription is necessary for some of the earliest stages of embryogenesis of the fruit fly. So for those who want to make the junk DNA or the junk RNA argument, you either have to pretend that the recent avalanche of data does not exist, or you would have to look very carefully to find a few very good instances of true junk.
So in other words, we haven't studied every nucleotide in every organism to understand exactly what it's doing, but you're talking about a trend line, a direction that research has been going. And it's not just a weak trend line. I mean, this is a powerful revolution that's taken place in biology over the last few decades, that we have just discovered vast tracts of the genome that perhaps were once not expected to have such important functions do, in fact, have very important functions. And this is ubiquitous throughout eukaryotic organisms that we've studied. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, I think that is correct. What we're finding, be it bacteria, be it eukaryotes, is that the number of roles that can be tracked back to DNA is increasing. And it's increasing because only until recently have we had the techniques to really begin exploring the functionality. The problem with exploring the functions of non-protein coding DNA and the RNAs that are derived therefrom is that it often tends to be repetitive. So it's often hard to track it down to one particular DNA segment. And that's a technical point. But also because the molecular techniques of 10 years ago and even 5 years ago were simply not there to elucidate function. And now we are beginning to unpack the various operations that these sequences play. And we've been completely taken by surprise. So in terms of a trend line, yes, it's going up. It certainly is not going down. And those who want to invoke, say, the onion test, which has become quite popular to argue for junk DNA in some form or the other, they should rethink their position. You're familiar with the onion test.
Yes, I believe you put it in the past that the onion has more DNA than it should, therefore there is no deity. Something to that effect?
Well, yes. That would be an extremely... Yes, condensed form of the statement. You have arguments that one can read to the effect that the onion cells have 30 times more DNA than we do. We do not consider the onion to be a particularly complicated organism. I really don't know how complicated an onion plant is. And the discrepancy can only be explained on the basis that much of the onion's DNA is superfluous. and therefore God would not have done it that way, hence, you know, some form of Darwinian or other neutral processes explains all of evolution. The problem with that line of argument is that the assumption is that having a lot of excess DNA is neither here nor there with respect to how cells operate. There's a clear-cut example, though, one that if you've studied genetics, you should be familiar with, that belies that argument, and it comes, again, from the fruit fly. During the larval stage of the fruit fly, it generates in many of the cell types what are called polyteen chromosomes. That is, the cell doesn't divide, but it keeps replicating its DNA sequences over and over and over and over. So you end up with, say, in a cell of a salivary gland of a fly larva, you end up with a chromosome that has 1,024 strands aligned. So in other words, what the fly larva is doing is generating vast amounts of repetitive DNA. It's amplifying its sequences specifically. There are a few it does not, but by and large, it creates giant chromosomes that are easy to observe. What are the effects of that excess DNA? Well, the nucleus is a lot larger than in the other cell types, considerably larger, as the chromosomes are. The cell becomes considerably larger. It changes the tissue shape, tissue dynamics. At the same time, what it allows those larval cells to do in preparation for metamorphosis is it allows a lot of RNA to be produced and a lot of protein to also be produced. So the idea that you can have a cell and just have vast amounts of excess DNA and it really has no effect on cellular physiology isn't true. It affects everything from the cellular dimensions to the mechanical properties of the cells and the tissues that they're in. So I'm not arguing that this means that the onion, all of the onion DNA is not junk. I'm not arguing that. What I am arguing, though, is that the assumption that excess DNA simply will have no effect on the observable traits of the organism is not true. At least in the case of a model organism that's been studied in detail, Drosophila, we know that having 1,024 copies of a particular DNA strand versus two does make a difference on many dimensions of the cellular operations. In the case of the onion, in case of other organisms that have a lot of so-called excess DNA, certainly you have other factors, such as the time it takes to replicate the DNA strand. I mean, the longer the DNA sequence, the longer it takes to replicate it and to produce RNA. One example is there's a gene, again in the fruit fly, that is approximately 2 to 3 million bases in length. Well, to transcribe that sequence takes between 2 to 3 days. And that turns out to be a timing mechanism. But anyway, length does matter in this particular context. And so that should be taken into account before throwing out the onion test as a case that excess DNA is neither here nor there.
Let's get back to the original question here of what is a gene? So in our modern understanding, modern being 2011, how do we understand a gene? What is a gene taken to mean and imply in our current understanding of biology?
Well, you have several different definitions of the gene at play at the present time. And the molecular biologist and philosopher of biology, Lenny Moss, has made the case, and I agree with him, that the gene that we think when we think of Mendel, of traits, of population genetics, is not the same as the gene of molecular biology. Those are two different concepts. There may be some intersection there, but the concept of a gene encoding a particular trait, say, I think that is completely passé. There are very few people who would make that argument.
Like one gene, one protein, one trait, basically. It's a lot more complicated.
It's a lot more complicated than that. The gene of population genetics, to a large extent, still remains an abstraction, to the extent that it's not rooted in the underlying DNA sequence. But when you get to cell biology and you start looking at the relations between a DNA sequence to RNA sequences there, let's just stop there. Let's forget about protein for the moment. Even there, it gets very, very complicated. And the reason is that you have phenomena like alternative splicing, where the RNA transcript is cut and repasted in different ways so that you can have different RNA products. And then you also have editing that is extensive in many organisms. And by editing, I mean you have rewrites that occur along the RNA sequence. It can even change the protein coding regions. So at the most fundamental level of the mapping, just DNA to RNA, it's tortuous. And so to come up at this stage with a clear-cut definition of the gene is a challenging problem. And as a result, you have no accepted definition. I mean, definition that appears to be universal for what a gene is at this time. I wouldn't say everyone is confused. Here's the analogy that I would use. Our understanding of the gene pre-2007 was akin to the model of the atom circa 1900, 1905. After 2007, and of course we had data that appeared to be anomalous before 2007, it became clear that we need a far more sophisticated model of what the gene is. Just like the study of electrons revealed that you had this wave-particle duality and therefore the old model of the atom was inadequate for the findings of the 1910s and 20s. So it's the same way in genetics. It's clear that the model that we had wasn't wholly incorrect. I'm not arguing that, but is insufficient. And we need an expanded model that takes into account the data that we have available. And so we are waiting for, if you will, the genetic equivalent of quantum mechanics to come along that will suddenly make sense of everything, even though it may be counterintuitive.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sternberg. It's been really fascinating to hear this history of our understanding of the gene and where biology is going today. It's clear that maybe not everything we learned in high school biology is wrong, but there's certainly a lot more to it. And I'm sure that in the coming years, a lot of discoveries are going to be made that will continue to add to our understanding of this. And what's interesting is that, and we'll probably be addressing this in many future podcasts, particularly with you, Dr. Sternberg, is that as we learn more about the nature of the genome, the more we're understanding that it points to intelligent design. So thank you very much for your time, and we appreciate your sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you for having me here, Casey.
I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.
Want to spend your summer studying intelligent design in Seattle for free? Discovery Institute is raising up the next generation of scientists and scholars with the 2011 summer seminars for college juniors, seniors, and graduate students. The two intensive 9-day learning opportunities run from July 8th through 16th. This year, in addition to the seminar focusing on ID and the natural sciences, the Center for Science and Culture announces the new C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society, which will explore the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts. Discovery Institute will pay expenses for students who are accepted into the programs, and applications are open now through April 22, 2011. For more information, visit www.discovery.org/STEM. That's www.discovery.org/SEM.